From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. Can you recession-proof your life? Well, whether you're employed by a company, self-employed, or unemployed, the state of the economy will affect you and your family. So what is the latest on the big picture financially, and how can you safeguard your future? Here with us is author and economist Julianne Malveaux. She is also the president of Bennett College. How you doing?
I'm great. How about you, Farai?
I'm doing great myself. Now, some people say even if America isn't in a recession yet, they are personally in jeopardy. So where do we actually stand today? Are we in a recession? What does that even mean?
Well, the technical definition of a recession is that you've seen negative GDP growth for more than two quarters. That's a very technical definition. Many Americans have been talking about recession or certainly economic hard times for the past year or even more.
And when you say technical, let me just jump in. When you say GDP, that's the gross domestic product?
Exactly. So when you see growth going down, you see yourself in a recession. And it's, you know, it's standard English, frankly. It's not rocket science. But the fact is that the macro numbers for Farai belie what the micro reality is for so many people. We've been seeing layoff numbers for over 2 years. We've seen a 5.2% unemployment rate. All of those things combine to speak to at least economic hard times, but the technical definition of a recession is that you have two quarters of GDP going down. Now, let's look at the next quarter, because right now we don't have that. What's a depression? The depression is an exacerbated recession. So you might see 4 to 6 to 8 quarters of this going down. How it manifests itself is in less jobs. We've already seen that. We see it in terms of higher inflation, and we see it in terms of truncated opportunities. What has laid over where we are now is this whole subprime mortgage thing, which hasn't yet shown up in the numbers, but everybody knows that it will. And so while we can say technically we're not in a recession today, as soon as these subprime mortgage numbers bubble up, we know that there are going to be some problems. And so all of the things that you and I have talked about over the weeks and many others have talked about in terms of the subprime lending, as we see those happen, we see more people in distress. And really, the bottom line on a recession is not the GDP numbers, but the number of people we see in distress.
I want to go into a few different specifics about unemployment and then also ask what are ways people can cope. So you mentioned the overall unemployment rate is about 5% and 9% for African Americans. That doesn't sound as bad as it could, does it? I mean, what I mean by that is there are some people who are left out of those figures. Tell us about them.
Well, there are some people who aren't looking for jobs anymore. They're not even being counted. There are some people who essentially were small or medium-sized business holders who folded their businesses. So the 5.2% that we capture probably represents just half of what's really going on. And for people of color, especially African Americans, you know that people are worse off than the overall numbers. So while these numbers are concerning, what should be more concerning is what we don't capture.
What about people who are self-employed? In these tight times, some people are starting to trim their budgets and they're cutting things like piano lessons for kids, gym memberships, things that don't have to do with just the very basic paying of bills and keeping a roof over your head and keeping folks fed. How does that really affect people who are self-employed?
Well, self-employed people are often other people's discretionary spending. In other words, if I'm cutting back, and I had a trainer who was coming into my house 3 times a week. Maybe now she's coming in twice or once. That hits her bottom line. So we know that essentially self-employed people, if their discretionary spending, are going to be on the front line. The message for them is to diversify your portfolio to make sure that now if you're counting on one person, let's get 3 lined up. Let's be more flexible. Let's deal with issues about how you might provide different kinds of payment schedules and other kinds of things. But self-employed people, whether they're personal services, which we've just talked about, whether they're business services, the people who do the graphic arts work, who do the editing and other things, they're going to have to dance on a dime because basically when people start cutting budgets, they're the easiest ones to cut.
Now, if you're self-employed, and there are many people who have started, you know, any number of businesses, if you're self-employed, either, like you said, doing personal services or running a small business with other employees who work for you, what can you do to shore yourself up financially?
Well, as I said, the first thing is to diversify for Ride, to make sure that you have a range of clients with a range of possibilities so that you're not just counting on one or two. The second thing, I think, is to look at ways that you can perhaps provide fee discounts so that you lock people in. Rather than to perhaps say, I'm going to do this hourly, get a retainer in so that you know that you have some kinds of money coming in. The self-employed are the most vulnerable. And the challenge is this. We already said to people, you've got to be flexible. You've got to be self-employed. You've got to do these things. And so now we know that these are the people who basically have a lot on the line as we move into a recession. They have to be as creative as they were in starting their business in order to keep their business.
What about everyone who has a regular 9-to-5 or a job with a company, let's put it that way? What kinds of things should we be looking at in terms of recession-proofing our lives?
People need to look ahead. What's going on? Do you think that there's going to be a layoff? Do you think there's going to be a cutback? And what are you going to do about it? Plan B, do you have one? What are you going to do about what happens if you're laid off? And then the issue with people who work for companies is to be what I call an intrapreneur, not an entrepreneur. How can you make yourself so indispensable that you're not the one they're going to fire? People look around and say, I've got to cut back 5 people in my unit. How can you be the indispensable one? How can you be the one that they say, oh, we can't let Farai go because she does news and notes and no one else can do news and notes?
If you're someone who's in an industry where you think, well, yeah, there are going to be a lot of cuts. Like, think about the people who had the axe fall at Countrywide, if you were in the mortgage industry. If you really think that you are about to be cut or if you are cut from your job, what then?
What kind of deal can you cut to give you as much time paid as you can to support yourself and your family? In other words, if you look around and you see that cuts are inevitable, are you going to be the first one or the last one in the door to cut a deal for yourself? There are deals to be cut. Lots of companies don't want you out there angry or mad. They want to make sure that they at least provide you with something. So how can you arrange something that takes care of you financially and get there early rather than late? They're going to respond to people who are there early with innovative possibilities. And innovative possibilities might include, I consult, I can do these things, I can do wrap up. But those who come late are those who are going to get leased.
We've talked a little bit about employment, but what about the other end of it, spending? We touch on that. Maybe if you're that personal trainer, you're upset if someone cuts down from 3 days to 2. But on a practical level, if you're someone who's making money, you probably have to think about cutting back on some of these things that are discretionary, whether it's dinner out on Friday nights, et cetera. What's a realistic way? None of us like to cut back on our lifestyle, but what's a realistic way to assess how much you need to trim back, if you should have a greater nest egg of savings just in case, you know, for your rainy day fund, et cetera?
The realistic thing is to look at this time. All of us are getting hit by this notion of the economy changing, and it means that some of us are going to have less money. What are you going to do about it? Make a plan and work it. You eat out 2 nights a week? Okay, now make it 1. Don't say you'll never eat out again, but make it clear how you're cutting back and why. I think additionally, it's really important to make sure that as you're cutting back and as you're looking at these things, you look at what it means for you in the long run. What are you doing about your savings, investments, and other things? Just because we're in economic hard times doesn't mean that those tried and true issues aren't very important. So you do two things. One, you look at cutting back, but two, you look at shoring up. You're shoring up your economic future. Depending on where you are in your life cycle, it may make sense for you to be very clear that your cutting back is a contribution to your retirement.
Speaking of which, I've noticed that my 401k dipped last quarter. I guess it's up and down in this economy. What can I do, if anything? I mean, should I start researching about switching things around or just accept that things are going to go up and down a little bit?
Things are going to go up and down for Rye, and that's real clear. I don't know who holds your 401k. You should talk to your financial advisor there to make sure that your ups and downs are not different than the market ups and downs. In other words, you don't want to be the one who's all the way at the bottom when others were at the median. And so you want to, everyone should take time. I always advocate one money day a month to look at all your money, figure it out, talk about it, reach out to your people, make sure that you're comfortable with what's happening with the oscillations. There will be oscillations always. For the past 6 or 7 years, we saw them moving upwards. Now we're seeing them moving down. With your 401k, Farai, here's the question. How much better off are you than you were 4 years ago? And if you're better off, you've got to do some research, but don't complain.
All right. I'm not complaining. Glad I have that retirement money. Julianne, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Author and economist Julianne Malveaux is president of Bennett College, and she spoke to us from the studios of WFDD in Greensboro, North Carolina. I'm Farai Chidea, and you're listening to News and Notes. Is time running out for Hillary Clinton in the race to grab presidential delegates? And Alicia Keys is making waves for criticizing the government and gangster rap. That's all on today's Bloggers Roundtable. With us, political commentator Jasmine Canick of jasminecanick.com, Eric Brown, blogger for the Detroit News' political and government blog, and Jay Smooth, who video blogs at illdoctrine.com. Hi, folks.
Hello.
I am doing great. Let's start out with politics. The Associated Press says Barack Obama seems on track to finish the primary season less than 100 delegates shy of the magic number needed to clinch the nomination. So that means he won't have it in hand, but he'll be so close he can taste it. If that's the case, it could be difficult for Senator Clinton to keep up a momentum and stay in the race. Now, on Friday, former senators and current superdelegates Sam Nunn and David Boren jumped on the Obama bandwagon. Robert Reich served as Secretary of Labor for President Clinton. He also endorsed Obama. So, Jasmine, why has Senator Clinton not been successful in wooing these superdelegates?
I think people see through her. I think people, this race has turned so nasty over the past few weeks. I think that's turned off a lot of people, including superdelegates. I know it's turned me off. I don't appreciate some of the comments that are being made. I think that Senator Obama has made a clear case for why he is or why he should be the next president of the United States. And I think that that message is reaching people, regardless of the fact that, you know, Senator Clinton continues to bring up, you know, Reverend Wright and certain ties that he has to people. And of course, the overblown media hype around his bitter comments, which I think a lot of people, including myself, identified with.
You know, Eric and Jay, I want to ask each of you first off, do you think that this race has gotten nasty? I mean, I'm coming from a different perspective of having covered politics now for, well, many years, let's just put it that way. And things are often mean, bitter, nasty. It seems to be just part of the package. I mean, Eric, first, do you think that this is a nasty campaign?
Well, I won't say nasty, so to speak. I would say more or less it has definitely gotten or has become obsolete, and that was proven by the debate last week on ABC. Right. People want to hear the issues. That's what people want to talk about. And the people, such as moderators, are not willing to talk about the issues. That's one of the reasons why so many people are turned off by politics, because you don't give people an opportunity, the candidates, that is, a chance to come before the people and talk about the issues. I don't need to know about who's wearing a lapel pin, who's lying about ducking sniper fire in Bosnia. Tell me about what's going on in the economy, what you're going to do for the economy once you become president. Tell me what you're going to do about gas prices. Tell me what you're going to do about universal health care. Those are the things that are of concern to me. And the nastiness that goes with it is exactly why people are able to identify more so with Barack Obama than so his opponent.
Jay, what do you think?
Well, I think, you know, compared to other races historically, it may not be that nasty, but it looks unusually nasty, I think, because these are two candidates who are so similar that it seems ugly to see two people and their supporters fight when their positions are so similar and they have really such similar visions. And I think the problem is that just this nominating system is really ill-equipped to handle such a close race with two strong candidates that are so similar. I mean, it just drags on and on. And each candidate has to think of new talking points to trot out every single day, and the media has to think of new things to say about what they said every day. And since they're so similar on the issues, that endless conversation strays further and further away from the issues until we're arguing over lapel pins and airplane trips with Sinbad. And I think it's, you know, it's unfortunate that the system is playing out that way. And I'm certainly looking forward to when we can start the real conversation comparing one of these candidates to McCain, because then there'll actually be something to talk about.
Jasmine, you're someone who obviously is plugged into politics 24/7, but when you talk to friends of yours who may be interested but not obsessed, are they kind of tuning out at this point, or what do you think people are doing at this point?
I think a lot of people are tuning out, even people like myself who, yes, it's true I am plugged into politics, but even I have to some degree tuned out just because of like what the other bloggers have said. We're not really discussing the issues. I want to talk about why I'm paying $4 a gallon for gas here in Los Angeles. I don't want to talk about who's wearing what. I don't want to, you know, hear over and over about a bitter comment. And so in that respect, I think a lot of people, again, including myself, have tuned out to some degree. And I am ready to start the real race, the race between, you know, the Democratic candidate against, you know, John McCain. That's what I'm ready for.
Eric, how much do you think people know about what a president does? And I bring that up only because when you think about things like why are we paying $4 for gas or, you know, any number of issues, there are a number of different factors, government sector and private sector, that can play into that. And the president does not have absolute authority to change everything. The president has some authorities to shape policies and to make certain executive decisions. Do you think, for example, if people are looking to Hillary Clinton or Barack Obama or McCain to fix their problems, that they don't understand what the limits on presidential power are?
Well, the Jay Leno piece with regards to jaywalking is any indication, people don't know much about much when it comes to politics. Most people cannot even tell you who one or either two of their senators are from the state that they are from. So I think that until people are really in tune to what politics is all about, the role of the president, the legislative branch, as well as the judicial branch, which you're supposed to learn in middle school, then it's just a name recognition context, so to speak. But one of the things that people should really be paying attention to is why is it that certain people that were in the first Clinton administration not endorsing Hillary Clinton? That's a telltale sign as to what she is about, why they're not endorsing her. But it's unfortunate people are not more involved in politics, or at least have a better understanding of what's about.
I want to move on to a topic that has some political overtones, but comes to us from the entertainment world. I'm talking about Alicia Keys. She is making headlines. She's on the cover of this month's Blender magazine. And an article quotes her as saying, "Gangsta rap was a ploy to convince black people to kill each other." And when the reporter asked who the ploy was by, she reportedly responded, "The government." Now, she's released a statement saying she was misrepresented, and her comments were in no way, quote, suggesting the government is responsible for creating this genre of rap music. So the controversial quotes actually were removed from Blender.com. Jay, she's not the only one who feels this way, if she feels this way. It seems as if she's saying, no, I didn't actually say that. But there are a lot of folks who believe that Tupac and Biggie were essentially assassinated, that their beefs were stoked by the government, that there have been cover-ups. There are all sorts of beliefs. What's the conversation, the state of the conversation about these issues, regardless of whether or not Alicia Keys actually said what the magazine said she said?
Well, I think, as has been said, this is similar in some ways to the Reverend Wright situation, in that there's a certain amount of shock in the media reaction, but this is a conversation that's very commonplace among people inside hip-hop culture. And I think, certainly the facts don't support the idea that they were assassinated or that the government created the genre known as gangster rap, but I don't think it's crazy to be suspicious of something going on when you look at the history of the American government and things like the COINTELPRO operation that went on in the 60s and 70s. And to me, the problem is not so much that it's crazy, just that it's counterproductive, because getting too caught up in conspiracy theories distracts you from figuring out which parts of the problem you can control. Because even if you look at how the COINTELPRO operation worked, they looked at groups like the Black Panthers and figured out what were the internal weaknesses of the group and how you could try to use those internal weaknesses to bring it down. So if you think that a COINTELPRO type thing is going on now, the way you should counteract that is by looking at your own internal weaknesses and trying to get your own stuff together. So the big concern that I have, even though some conspiracy theories may be true, is that when we get caught up obsessing over that, it distracts us from the work at hand that we can do to improve our own situation.
Eric, what about the aspect of criticism of gangster rap? You know, there's actually now been a reply by 50 Cent who said, "I don't like people who don't like me. That statement changes my perception of Alicia Keys totally. It's just not really a bright comment." Now, the reality is plenty of people criticize gangster rap. Again, is this just an issue where, it's about time that some people raise these questions?
Well, to a certain degree, it's much ado about nothing. I think Jay hit the nail on the head. It's counterproductive, number one. And number two, there are more important issues. This is just my opinion. There are more important issues that we can be talking about as it relates to black life in America than talking about conspiracies as it relates to two entertainers that ended up dead. I mean, I'm not that, you know, I find it ironic and kind of hypocritical when you have rappers talk about all these conspiracies, or even anyone in the entertainment field, but at the same time, they continue to play the role of the pseudo gangster and make money off of spewing the type of lyrics that they spew.
And Jasmine, when you look at this, how much of a sense of internal critique should come from people in the music industry? I mean, what makes this situation difficult to talk about is that, you know, she's saying that she did not actually put these comments up, and we're still waiting for more news on that. But don't entertainers have a right to be a part of a conversation about not just the future of music as an industry, but also about what it does to us as a society? Shouldn't there be more entertainers who actually are part of a debate and a dialogue?
I mean, I think it's good anytime you can get, you know, any of the entertainers, I guess, to speak on a quote unquote political issue. But I have to say, like, you know, until this story was brought to me by the producer that we were going to talk about it, it's not something that I even cared about or even cared to blog about, because it's just, for me, it's not important. I mean, I find it very interesting that 50 Cent could find the wherewithal to issue a response to this, considering some of the madness that's come out of his mouth. I don't think he needs to be criticizing anyone. I think I would echo the sentiments of, Eric and Jay, and just say that, you know, let's talk about gangsta rap, but let's talk about it in present day sense. Let's talk about what it's doing to us today and what we continue to allow it to do in our communities. You know, I do follow conspiracy theories on certain things. I do think there's something behind the whole gangsta rap phenom. You know, I am a West Coast girl, been around for the Eazy-E and all of that, came up through all of that. But today, when I look at gangsta rap and I look at the influence that it has had on our young adults, those are the discussions that I want to have on how, as entertainers, they can, you know, look at some of the words that are coming out of their mouth and how it is influencing our kids and what they are doing to our community with those words.
I agree.
Well, you're listening to NPR's News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. And if you're just tuning in with me on today's Bloggers Roundtable, we've got political commentator Jasmine Canik of jasminecanik.com, Eric Brown, blogger for the Detroit News' political and government blog, and Jay Smooth, who video blogs at illdoctrine.com. Eric, we've got one last topic, and it's a government one, so it'll be good for you. The former HUD Secretary Alfonso Jackson may be out of a cabinet job, but he's still in the news. He resigned, and now he's under investigation for possibly enriching himself and friends with lucrative government contracts. Now, the New York Times says a developer friend received a $127 million contract to rebuild a New Orleans housing project. That developer's company paid Jackson more than $250,000 in fees. And You know, supporters of Jackson say his critics are going after him because he was enriching other black Republicans. The Times said that in the years he was in office, HUD contracts to African Americans went from 14% before he was there to 25%. Is this one of those "you're going after me because I'm black" things, or is there smoke and possibly fire?
Well, I'm not big on the victimization of blacks, but one thing that blacks in politics and any high profile position have to always be careful of is to make sure all your I's are dotted and T's are crossed, because all it takes is a perception that you're doing something wrong. And if he found a way to make sure that minority contracts were increased, because part of the government mantra is to ensure that minorities are involved in all these different type of projects. So on the one hand, you want to say this is what we are about, to ensure that everyone has an equal footing as it relates to getting these type of contracts. But then because the amount of contracts to minorities goes up, someone wants to make a big deal about it, then you start investigating people, and then you try and find out, okay, where's this extra money coming from that he has in his bank account? I mean, I think that's ludicrous. You can't say how you want to improve the involvement of all races, then you find a way to say, okay, he did something wrong because those people that he reached out to get more contract to look like him. I mean, that's not fair as it relates to that. But again, you have to be careful, make sure the I's are dotted and T's are crossed. Don't give them a reason to come after you in the future.
Jasmine, some folks will say, okay, maybe Alphonso Jackson wasn't the cleanest tool in the shed, but then they'll point to someone like Vice President Dick Cheney. He was a former employee of Halliburton, which went on to get no-bid contracts for providing services during the war. The whole question of government contracts is one that some folks say we should take a closer look at. What do you think?
Well, absolutely, we should take a closer look at it. And I'm glad you brought up Dick Cheney, because I was about to do the same thing. I think, you know, one of the working around so many black politicians, you know, it is a mantra. If you are a black politician, you always have to make sure your I's are dotted and your T's are crossed. And you always have to know that you're going to be scrutinized more than anyone else's. And so I find it really hard to believe that, you know, Mr. Jackson would allow himself to be in this sort of position. So I think that maybe there is something to the fact that maybe because he is an African-American and these were, you know, minority contracts that may, you know, because I just find it really hard to believe that I'm sure he knows as a black man in this particular administration that he is going to be scrutinized.
Hey, people have found money in refrigerators.
I know.
I'm never surprised by anything in
politics. I'm not surprised either, but I just find that hard to believe that he wouldn't take note of that and be very careful. So, I mean, it'll be interesting to find out what happens. I would never go so far to say that, you know, blacks in positions like this, you know, would never do anything wrong, because you're right. We have found thousands of dollars in freezers and so on and so forth. And let's just hope that as the investigation continues that he comes out, you know, clean.
All right. Well, I'm sorry, Jay, we don't have time for a final comment from you, but I want to thank all of you.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
That was political commentator Jasmine Kanick of jasminekanick.com. She was in our NPR West studios. Eric Brown, blogger for the Detroit News' political and government blog, and Jay Smooth, who video blogs at illdoctrine.com. He was at our NPR New York studios. I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. Pennsylvania voters go to the polls tomorrow in that state's Democratic presidential primary. One of the hot-button issues is guns. Some voters want free access to guns for hunting and self-protection. Other people say guns are too easy to get, and they are fueling high murder rates in urban Pennsylvania. We've got two Pennsylvanians on tap to talk local and national politics and the impact of race on the eve of this highly watched primary. Jamira Burley is a Temple University freshman and co-founder of the Panther Peace Corps, an organization that trains students in conflict resolution. And Thaddeus Mathis is a Temple University professor of social administration and co-director of the Center for African American Research and Public Policy. Welcome, folks.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
So, Jamira, let's start with you. Philadelphia has one of the highest murder rates in the country, and you and your family have been through the fire with that. Can you tell me what happened?
Yes. In 2005, I was in my 10th grade year of high school, and my brother Andre was actually murdered due to gunshot wounds in his sleep. So I'm pretty aware of the social issues surrounding violence in Philadelphia.
Now, you were still in high school when your brother was killed, and a lot of people would have just gotten depressed, but you actually were inspired in addition. What did you decide to do, and what kind of, tell us about your organization?
Yes, after the murder of my brother, my eyes were pretty much open wide. I started really noticing that the effects that violence had on the people surrounding me in my community, in addition to my peers. And one of the things that really helped me to deal with the pain that I was going through was actually starting the Peace Corps organization, which was founded at Overbrook High School, which is a peer mediation organization called the Panther Peace Corps that solely focused on decreasing the violence of, in Overbrook High School environment. And some of the things we did was peer mediation. The students actually monitor the hallways, and they have keys to the bathrooms, so they're able to open and close the doors when in between classes. And the peer mediation really helped students in our surrounding area because it gave students an opportunity to really talk out their issues without resorting to the use of violence. And now, because of that program, is actually going to be expanded to the top 10 persistently dangerous high schools in Philadelphia.
Professor Mathis, you must be really, in some ways, inspired by hearing about this story. But there's, you know, there's the issue of national politics, and your state is front and center in them right now. Senator Barack Obama got into hot water with that issue of saying that rural Pennsylvanians cling to, among other things, guns. Do you think that as you hear this story, urban and rural Pennsylvanians have different perspectives on this, that there's a real divide between people who live in cities and see guns one way and people who live in the country and see guns another way?
Well, I think no doubt about it. The you know, just the difference between urban environments and rural environments makes the proliferation of guns and the availability of the sort of high-powered guns that have no real value in the kind of hunting and other pursuits that rural Pennsylvanians may be into. There's a market in the cities for producing guns for use on the streets. Those are the kinds of things we need our elected officials to find a way to address.
How much do you put on national politicians to deal with these issues, like presidential candidates, Professor? I mean, is this really something that you think should be dealt with by a presidential candidate or by local officials, or does it have to be a collaboration?
Well, I think a collaboration. There's no doubt that this issue of gun violence is a national phenomenon, so we certainly do need some national attention addressed to it. But there are local dimensions of it as well. And so we need officials at all levels of government and private individuals at all levels of community life to step forward on an issue like this.
Jamira, let me turn to you. You have scholarships. You're at Temple. Right now, a lot of the focus that people are looking at in terms of their own personal lives is economics. You know, can we make it? Can you achieve your dreams? How are you dealing in terms of scholarship money? Or do you think that it's going to be there for you throughout your college career?
I think eventually it will dry up, just for the simple fact that there's a lot of scholarships that I received during my first year, but next year, most likely, I will have to take out loans. And the thing that really scares me is the interest rate on a lot of these loans. And it's like I go to college to get an education in order to better myself so the way I can live the type of lifestyle that I want to after I graduate. But because of these loans, for the first couple of years after I graduate, I will be paying them back instead of trying to develop in a lifestyle that I want. So that's really a big issue to me. So these college loans is really scary.
And you're the first person in your family to graduate from high school, the first to go to college. There have to be a lot of hopes and dreams pinned to you. What responsibility do you feel, you're already giving back, but what responsibility do you feel as someone who's breaking new ground to give back once you graduate? Because you could probably make more money, honestly, if you go into a field where perhaps you're not doing as much directly for the community, but I suspect that you're the kind of person who's going to want to continue some of the work you've already started.
Yeah, there's a lot of stress on me. Coming from a family with 15 brothers and sisters, there's a lot of stress just for the simple fact I have 5 younger brothers and sisters who really look up to me. So it's my job to really not do anything that will shy them away from the goal that I set out for them. I want them to believe that they have an opportunity to go to college and that it is possible for them to graduate high school. And for me, it's like college loans now, not having the funding to really continue my education, is not going to stop me from continuing my education. I will graduate from college and I will go get my master's. But it's going to be a lot of hard work considering that the funding is not available. But I'm going to make it work.
Professor, when you think about the big picture of education and the influence that education can have on everything from crime rates to parenting, how important is it in your mind that the person who you vote for in the presidential race, as well as people in local politics, really focus on education?
Oh, it's absolutely important. Education is the key to getting out of the environments that trap so many of our youth. It is certainly a key to the labor market. It is a key to the issue of violence. It is the key to having some hope for the future. Without an education, you're locked into an environment that increases your risk for many of the ills that we see. Not just in urban areas, but in all areas of social and cultural life.
Jamira, you're 19, and this is the first time you'll be able to vote in a presidential election. First off, are you planning to vote? And secondly, what about your friends? Do you get any sense that people are excited about participating in the primary and then in the general election?
I'm very excited, and yes, I will be voting on Tuesday. I don't know what to say. Like, I'm really excited. This is the first election that I'm allowed to vote in. And not only that, this is an history-making election. A lot of my peers are very excited. They're pushing each other to really go out and vote on Tuesday. In addition, I've been signing up students to actually get registered in the last couple of months. So the youth, especially around Temple's campus and the surrounding areas, are definitely looking out to go and vote on Tuesday and to be a part of this kind of election.
Professor, what do you see from the students on campus?
Oh, I haven't seen this much activity in quite some time. And it's not just on the campus, but in the neighborhoods as well. And I think you see it reflected in the large number of new registrations in Pennsylvania, and particularly centered in Philadelphia, as well as the large number of independents who've changed their registrations to participate in this particular primary.
Jamira, given that you come from such a large family, do you talk to your family as well? And, you know, do you urge them to go out and vote? And what about the younger ones, too? Do you tell them about what it means to be politically engaged?
I've already talked to my little brothers and sisters about the presidential election, and I've told them about each of the candidates. And my little sister and my brothers actually have their favorites. My brothers, I've actually registered to vote a couple months ago, so they're looking out to go and vote on Tuesday, too. But it was very difficult for me to force them to vote. I mean, not even force them to vote, for me to inform them the importance of voting, because they were one of the type of people that believed that their vote didn't count. I really gave them the details and made them understand that how important this election was and for them to really pick a candidate who will represent them and their issues the best.
Professor, do you ever talk to your students about that same issue if they feel that there's no point in voting? Just briefly, give us a sense of what you might say to them.
Well, I teach primarily graduate students, so it's a different conversation with them. Many of them are already clear about their reasons for either participating or not participating. A lot of the students I have are more independent minded. I teach in the School of Social Work, and so they're either already heavily engaged in campaigns or they're already heavily engaged in advocacy issues.
Well, that sounds like you're in a good position then. Professor and Jamira, I just want to thank you so much.
No problem.
We were speaking with Thaddeus Mathis, a Temple University professor of social administration. He's also the co-director of the Center for African American Research and Public Policy, and Jamira Burley, a Temple University freshman. She's the co-founder of the Panther Peace Corps, an organization that trains students in conflict resolution. And they both joined me from the studios of WRTI on the campus of Temple University in Philadelphia. Eric Jerome Dickey has written a string of best-selling novels about contemporary African-American life. We've seen popular authors, including Walter Mosley, write books in genres that are new for them, including erotica. Now Dickey has followed suit. His latest work, Pleasure, is an erotic story about love, jealousy, and obsession, but with a twist. I asked him to describe the book's heroine.
Nia Simone. She was born in Trinidad. There's a lot of poverty in Trinidad, and a lot of, I guess, what we call gang activity. And her dad was of that lifestyle and unfortunately died before she was born. She speaks on it just a little bit in the book. It's not a major part of the book, but it's part of who she is. And her mother met someone who was from the States and married him, moved back to the States. So Nia has grown up around a lot of successful, you know, I guess for us, Hollywood, a lot of successful people. But her personality is that she'd rather be a writer, some person who's in the background, than to be in front of the camera.
So she's a ghostwriter, and
right.
As you are a writer and you create characters, she creates characters as well. But she's not just
right.
She's not just about creating a character. She is a character. What sorts of pleasure does she go about seeking?
She's at a place now where she's very interested, I guess, in sexual pleasure. And the difficulty, I guess, for her is engaging in someone physically, sexually, without it becoming overwhelming, as a lot of relationships for a lot of people tend to do. I think she wants to be able to keep it at a particular level. As we're getting into the book, she's breaking up with someone who is very obsessed with her, but she is very done with this individual.
So, without getting too deep into it, there is a menage a trois, which runs throughout the book, and I will leave it at that. But
well, she's involved with several people.
Yes,
it's better like that. So it's not just a menage a trois. It's that trying to obtain pleasure beyond what you're used to. You know, a lot of stuff that people fantasize about. She's in a position where she can actually see what it's like.
Now, what about the literary aspects of this? There are people use the words literature, romance, erotica, and pornography. Where's right. your book in that?
Probably depends on what chapter you're reading at the time. It's probably all of those things. I don't know who decides what goes into what box or what bin on what shelf, you know. For me, it's just about finding the character, finding the story, following, I guess, my heart, you know, what I'm working on at the moment. And it just kind of, you know, falls wherever it may after that, you know.
There's been a lot of attention to the whole idea of street lit. And Zane, who's an erotica writer, extremely popular, sells a ton of books. A lot of people are like, well, she just can't write, but there's a lot of sex in it. And there's also a question that some people have raised about whether or not it is good for the race to have books that are explicit about black sexuality out there. The black race. And so I bring this up because so often when people, you know, mm-hmm. just as you mentioned the distinctions between the way some people will look at female sexuality and male sexuality
right.
and what it's like to have a track record and whether that makes you a bad person, you know, people also look at these distinctions by race and say, oh, well, black people are oversexed. That's some people stereotyping. Are you ever afraid that by doing work like this that you're, you know, I don't know, playing into a stereotype?
I'm writing what I like. I'm writing what I love. I'm writing the type of story I wanted to write at the moment. you know, I guess to just go back to this nation's fear of black people and sexuality and black people and sex. I mean, you don't see it on the big screen. There's no.
So in a way, you seem to be saying that black sexuality is constrained by the way that people, you know, perceive what should be on the movie screen or what should be in the pages of a book.
Well, yeah, all of that is. I mean, it's for the most part, everybody in this country, on this planet, got here through some erotic moment. And yet that's what we are the hardest on, you know, talking about erotica, talking about sex. I mean, then you throw it back into the, you know, then you whittle it down to somehow being African-American and writing books that have erotica or sex in it. It's somehow a negative thing. And I just don't get that.
So when you think about your readers and the people who are going to pick up this book, who do you imagine your readers will be, and what do you want them to take away from it?
I hope it's little old white women in Minnesota.
Probably at least a few.
It's this, or Waking with Enemies, or Sleeping with Strangers, or Friends and Lovers. It's all for me. It's always the same thing. Hopefully, it's a good story with good characters that once you pick it up and it pulls you into the book. There is story. There is plot. There is complicated characters, complicated situations, complicated relationships. And at the end of the day, at the end of the novel, it's much more complex than just Nia and her pursuit of desire. It's that for her, and just for her, it's this thing where you want pleasure, but you want to be able to control this pleasure. And at some point, it gets out of control.
Eric, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Eric Jerome Dickey's latest novel is called Pleasure. You can read an excerpt at our website, nprnewsandnotes.org.